Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. The iconic Western Joshua Tree in California's desert has been struggling to survive. Scientists now predict that due to environmental stress fueled by the climate crisis, these beautiful, fragile California plants could be largely gone from their namesake Joshua Tree National Park by the end of the century. While the species has also been threatened by commercial and real estate development and invasive plants, the most dramatic and visible threat has been the devastating wildfires that have destroyed an untold number of them in the Mojave National Preserve, where this summer's York Fire burned almost 100,000 acres. The Hackberry Complex Fire back in 2005 torched another 71,000 acres, and the Dome Fire in 2020 burned 43,000 acres, destroying about 1.3 million Joshua trees. So to protect these longtime residents of the desert, in July, California enacted the Western Joshua Tree Conservation Act. According to the LA Times, the act prohibits unpermitted killing or removal of the trees. It tasks state wildlife authorities with developing and implementing a conservation plan for the species by 2024, and it creates a fund to acquire and manage suitable habitat. So to discuss the significance of this act and to find out more about what can be done to ensure the survival of the Western Joshua Tree, we're so pleased to be joined by two guests. First, we have Brendan Cummings, who is the Conservation Director of the Center for Biological Diversity and a Joshua Tree resident. So welcome to the program, Brendan.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Dr. Cameron Barrows, Professor Emeritus and Research Ecologist at UC Riverside. So thank you for joining us, Professor Barrows.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
So before we dive in and talk about the impact of climate change on the desert and these fragile plants, for people who are not that familiar with Joshua trees and their cultural and environmental significance, Professor Barrows, I was wondering if you could just give us some basic facts about them.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So Joshua trees are actually have been divided into two species in California and Nevada, but they are basically a large member of the asparagus family of all things. They're one of the few trees in the desert, and that gives them special significance because by being a tree and having that kind of structure, And I want to step back a little bit and say some people would argue that they're not a true tree because they're a member of the asparagus family, but they have a trunk and they have branches and they can be 30, 40, 50 feet tall in some cases. So they act like trees. And in doing so, they provide habitat and homes for countless numbers of birds and insects and lizards that otherwise would not be able to occur there. So they are what we sometimes say in ecology as a keystone species, the keystone meaning that if you remove a keystone from an archway, the archway falls down. So if you remove a keystone species, it's not just that species that is lost. You have a domino effect of many other species that are impacted.
And Professor Barrows, just staying with you, some scientists say that the Joshua trees could be wiped out within the national park by 2100. Can you explain why there are dying, why they are dying, and you know how much risk are they at given that right now there are millions of these trees?
Yes, and that's one of the things that causes people who have driven through the desert or been to the desert one time or another saying, well, there's so many of them out there. How could they be endangered? And one of the things that you need to look at when you look at a stand of Joshua trees is not just these big 30, 40 foot, you know, foot trees, is are there any baby trees out there? Are there any young ones underneath? And what we're seeing is on greater and greater landscapes that there is no reproduction happening. So these trees might be able to live for 200-300 years, maybe a little bit longer. But if there's no reproduction coming in underneath them, then they are essentially doomed. And that's what we're finding. So as you have a drier and hotter environment, the young Joshua trees, the seeds, even if they do sprout, they don't have the capacity to hold water like their adults do. And so when you have even a minor drought, all of the cohort of young Joshua trees are killed. So that's what we're seeing, is that even though there's lots of adults out there and it looks like, you know, to the average person, what's the problem? What you really need to do is look for the young trees. And the young trees are in very small areas right now. Within Joshua Tree, it's probably only about a third or less of the area of Joshua trees within the national park that are reproducing at this point. And I think that's the real cause for concern, is if you're not seeing reproduction, the population is doomed. It's similar to human beings. If we stop having babies, even though there's plenty of adults out there, the population is doomed.
So, Professor Barrows, at this rate, what would be your prediction for when we might lose this species entirely if we continue on our current trajectory?
Well, and that's the big question, is if we do absolutely nothing and we just move ahead, assuming that, you know, our needs of driving cars and so forth are supersede all the other animals and plants on the planet. So if we make that assumption, then probably, you know, 2100 wouldn't be unreasonable to start seeing widespread mortality. And and just to step back a little bit, one of the things that I do research on, or have done research on, is to identify what we call climate refugia, areas within a region like the desert where it's a little bit cooler, a little bit wetter, and that there's a little bit more time to ensure that these species do not go extinct. And so by 2100, certainly there is going to be widespread destruction of Joshua Tree forests within the Mojave Desert. There's no question about that. But there are likely to be areas a little bit higher elevation, north-facing slopes, a little bit closer to the coast, that will probably be able to sustain Joshua Trees for a little bit longer, maybe another, you know, half a century or so. But if we continue to do nothing, then they will almost certainly be lost, along with the amazing biodiversity of the desert. I think one of the points that I'd like to make here is that a lot of people think of deserts as a wasteland, and it's really the exact opposite. You know, California has more biodiversity, meaning more unique plants and animals, than any other state in the United States. In fact, if you added all the other states of the United States together, California still has more than all the rest together. So then if you look at California and say, where is that biodiversity? And it's not evenly distributed. It turns out a huge amount of that, in terms of plants, in terms of reptiles, in terms of insects, is in our deserts. And so when we start losing these keystone species and this domino effect happens, we lose more and more that we're not even talking about here.
And let me bring in Brendan Cummings from Center for Biological Diversity. Brendan, I know you live in the Joshua Tree area. What changes have you seen recently affecting the Joshua Tree due to the climate stress, development, and other pressures we've talked about?
I've seen quite a lot of change. But, you know, as Cameron noted, sometimes the change is subtle. So, you know, 15 or so years ago, I did the legal work to get polar bears protected under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And this was the first time a species had been legally protected due to the threats of climate change. And I did that sitting in Joshua Tree, looking out my window at Joshua Trees. And while there were some studies coming out showing threats to the species and reduced reproduction, it was really hard to feel that they were truly threatened, just because you see so many of them over such a broad area. But, you know, once you learn to look, and as Cameron was saying, start counting the trees, looking for young trees, you realize you're not seeing reproduction. The other thing that has started to occur on large scale, you know, it's been a sort of this exponential growth that suddenly became overwhelming, was invasive grasses. So, you know, the desert used to be a relatively sparse landscape where you'd have intermittent Joshua trees, shrubs around them, but a fair bit of bare ground. And that meant that fires were relatively small. But over the past few decades, these invasive grasses have just filled in the gaps. And so we now have massive fires, where once we had 1 acre or less fires, we now have, you know, fires that are tens of thousands of acres, and they're killing lots of Joshua trees. And then lastly, the other threat that's all too obvious is development. you know, Joshua Tree 2 decades ago was a pretty sleepy community focused on the national park. And since then, you know, so much of the Joshua Tree habitat that buffers the park on its northern boundary has been fragmented, bulldozed, and developed, often in the service of providing places to stay for people who want to come see Joshua trees. So we're destroying that which we love.
Well, Brendan, you mentioned invasive grass. Is there any plans to try to eradicate these invasive species? Could that be one potential mitigation strategy?
It definitely can be a mitigation strategy. It's difficult, and I'm sure Cameron can talk about some of this as well. One thing that's a positive in it is part of the reason we have invasive grasses is that the desert soils are in essence being fertilized by nitrogen deposition from smog wafting in from Los Angeles and the Inland Empire. And so as we replace our smokestacks and tailpipes with, you know, renewable energy and EVs, there will be less nitrogen coming in, and the native desert plants that are better adapted to low nitrogen soils can maybe outcompete these invasive plants. But that's a slow process. In the near term, I think we're going to have to do a lot of active management, which is, you know, a very different paradigm than what conservationists are often used to in the terms of land protection. You know, a national park, its framework is leave nature alone. But in an era of climate change and invasive grasses, if we want to save Joshua trees and other species, we may need to do, you know, things more proactive, you know, weeding the wilderness. Mm-hmm.
So let me invite in listeners here. This is Ethan Elkind. I'm guest hosting for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls One Planet series. As you're hearing, we're talking about the future of the Western Joshua trees in California. We want to hear from you. Are you worried about the future of Joshua trees? Have you visited the desert in Southern California, Nevada, where these trees are located? What changes have you seen? What do you hope is done to try to preserve these species? You can join our conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. And I'm joined by Brendan Cummings, Conservation Director for the Center for Biological Diversity and a Joshua Tree resident, and Dr. Cameron Barrows, Professor Emeritus and Research Ecologist at UC Riverside. Dr. Barrows, I wanted to ask you, what do you think needs to be done given this situation? We've talked about some of the threats to the Joshua tree, from development to invasive species to climate change. What steps do you think need to be taken right now if we want to try to save this species for the long term?
I can think of a couple of things, one of which is, as I mentioned earlier about these climate refugia, is to identify where those climate refugia are and ensure that those are protected from either future development, which there is plenty of development happening in the deserts right now with solar development and other things, which is an interesting problem because solar development's going to help us with climate change, but solar development can also hasten the demise of Joshua trees if it's done in the wrong places. So identifying these climate refugia and then essentially making those sacrosanct, that we're not going to do bad things there or destroy the habitat, I think would be an important first step. You were mentioning with Brendan about the invasive species, which is a huge, huge issue, and it's going to push Joshua trees to extinction probably faster than climate change will if the fires continue at the rate they're happening. Because once that fire happens, there is virtually no reproduction happening in these areas because of the heat and so forth. So that's a problem. It's a serious problem. The national park has done some things that are trying to reduce fuels. It's more than just weeding, which is part of it, but it's creating fire breaks so that if a big fire happens, it doesn't get bigger and bigger. And I think that might be another step, is to keep fires as small as they possibly can be by creating fire breaks and those sorts of things.
And Professor Barrows, you talked about how the plants really aren't propagating now. I'm just curious, how long can those seeds survive if the temperatures keep rising? I mean, are we going to be able to count on these seeds sort of being there for the right conditions? And I guess a related question might be, what's the highest temperature that this species can tolerate?
I don't know the highest temperature. Certainly we have, it's not just temperature. It's the dryness and the lack of water. And so I think that's the one thing that we have to make it really clear. The desert sometimes gets to 110, 120 degrees. That does not kill Joshua trees. What kills Joshua trees is having years of drought. And on top of that, hotter temperatures, which are, is wicking the water out of the soil. So as much as temperature is driving it, the, what is really happening is it's a water issue. It's not enough water to keep the seedlings alive. Not enough water to keep the adults alive ultimately, but it's not, the temperature itself is not going to kill the Joshua tree. It's the lack of water.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for explaining that. I appreciate it. And Brendan, let me ask you about the law that just passed in Sacramento in July that we mentioned at the introduction of the show, the Western Joshua Tree Conservation Act. Can you just walk us through the history of how this act came together and why it was needed and the sort of overall legal status of the Joshua tree before and potentially after this act?
Yes, happy to do so. So unlike the federal government, which 15 or so years ago recognized climate change as a threat under the Federal Endangered Species Act, California has never done so under the California Endangered Species Act. So in 2019, I submitted a petition, which is a sort of legal scientific document, to the state seeking protection of the Western Joshua tree under the California Endangered Species Act due to the three threats of development, fire, and climate change. And that set off a process which was and ultimately ended up being highly controversial. The Western Joshua tree is about half its range, depending on how you map it, is on private land. And the high desert home of the Joshua tree, those private lands are some of the last readily developable, cheap real estate in the state. And so they're facing intense development pressure from all sorts of things, you know, the Amazon warehouse, the giant solar project, big housing projects, some of which, you know, one could argue are an important part of what the state needs to be doing. So there is this tension of you have a species threatened by climate change, but that currently occupies a large area with a lot of them that an area is subject to development. If you protect them as one traditionally does with the threatened or endangered species, you know, you take them from local land use regulation under till state management where they'll need state permits. That's where we ultimately ended up with the Western Joshua Tree Conservation Act. But to cut a very long story short, there was a split in the California Fish and Game Commission, a 2-2 tie among the four commissioners who were sitting at the time as to whether or not the tree qualified for listing. And even the no votes acknowledged it met the definition of a threatened species under the law, but didn't like the legal implications of protection. And that created this political legal crisis that was ultimately resolved by the legislature with the Western Joshua Tree Conservation Act. And what that does is sets a protective regime similar to what it, the species would have had under the California Endangered Species Act, but sort of easier to administer, cheaper to implement permitting regime to deal with the fact that there are so many of them on so many private parcels. And then what it does, which is unique because it's climate informed, it mandates preparation of a conservation plan by the end of next year that will explicitly take climate change, fire, and other things into consideration. And it also, the permitting scheme is designed to look at things landscape scale. So the money generated by permits will be put in a big pot with the goal of, you know, landscape level conservation that's climate informed. And so when I look at implementation over this bill over the next, you know, 2, 3, 5 years, the way I'd like to see it, one thing that comes to mind is, you know, anyone who's driven up Highway 101 north of the Bay Area you know, we'll see signs for Redwood National and State Parks, which is this patchwork protected land area for one of California's other iconic trees. In for Joshua trees, right now we have them protected in Joshua Tree National Park, which is on the southernmost part of their range where they're most vulnerable to climate, but they also occur across other portions of the Mojave. And I would ultimately like our conservation efforts to sort of congeal upon a Joshua Trees state and national parks that's sort of a network designed to protect all the refugia that Dr. Barrows identifies and is managed to do climate-informed protection of this species to ensure we still have it, you know, a decade from now, 5 decades from now. Mm-hmm. And if we do everything necessary to protect the Joshua tree in the face of the changing climate, we won't just protect it as a keystone species, but also as an umbrella species that protects the rest of the ecosystem that comes along with it, as well as the human communities that I live in and others in the desert do. Because everything we do to protect Joshua trees will also help make our desert communities more livable, more sustainable in the face of the very, very difficult decades ahead.
Well, Brendan, I appreciate you explaining what the law is going to do and some of the history there, because it is fairly complicated, but it does seem like a landmark law. And Professor Barrows, I wanted to get your opinion on the law that just passed in Sacramento. Do you think this is an important step? Do you think it's going to make a difference for saving the species in the long term?
Well, I usually leave all things legal to Brendan. He's the expert and I'm not. I think that because of the deadlock on the Fish and Game Commission and their unwillingness to move forward, and because of that, I think this is an important step. I think we have to be really careful about this. I have some friends that live up in Joshua Tree, and they complain. They love Joshua trees and they want to continue to keep Joshua trees. But I think this is in Yucca Valley, which is a neighboring community, that they are being forced to change from septic systems to a municipal sewer system, which makes perfect sense. And that's a good thing, you know, to protect the groundwater supply. But if the digging of the trench that takes the water, you know, or the sewage from their house into the sewage system impacts a Joshua tree, they're being fined this huge amount of money. And it doesn't, they keep coming to me and saying, well, that doesn't make any sense. We're not protecting Joshua trees on my, you know, 50 by 50 acre lot, or 50, not 50 by 50 acre, 50 by 50 square foot lot. We're protecting them in places like Joshua Tree or this state park system that Brendan is envisioning, which is exactly what we should be doing. And so I think we have to be really careful, because if we're not careful, we're not going to engender the public support that I would say is overwhelmingly in favor of protecting Joshua trees as long as it's done right.
Mm-hmm. And Brendan, we've talked a bit about the development pressures, and I think one of the interesting conflicts here, or potential conflicts, is with large-scale renewable energy developers. You've mentioned how the desert is a lot of pressure to build some of these large-scale facilities to meet our long-term climate goals. The state says we need to triple our current build rate of these renewable energy facilities, and this is to address, you know, this underlying challenge here of climate change that is ultimately threatening this species and many other species around the world. So how do we balance these trade-offs where some of these large-scale solar facilities are going to need to take out some of these Joshua trees, but we also need the carbon-free electricity? So what's the large-scale solar industry's perspective on this law, and how do you view the trade-offs here and the challenges negotiating these two competing interests?
Yes, it's a very difficult challenge in the sense that we absolutely need to get to 100% renewables as soon as possible, you know, ideally a decade ago, but certainly within the coming decade. And where we do that, how we do that is the biggest issue. Obviously, it should as much as possible on rooftops, disturbed lands, over our roadways, parking lots, things of that sort. But we still probably need, certainly under our utility-centric model, large scale projects, that's, you know, the economy of scale. And so the question is where you put them. And right now, until the protection of Joshua trees, the economic incentives made it easier and cheaper to mow down a Joshua tree woodland in the Antelope Valley than to put the project right next door on, you know, fallowed farmland that's long since been disturbed. My goal with Joshua tree protection is to shift those incentives so that ultimately it economically makes more sense to put it on the disturbed land than on the Joshua tree woodland. In the near term, what we're seeing, and part of the political compromise that led to this bill, is there's a lot of solar projects that were already in the pipeline, that had already signed their contracts, had been financed, had gone through all other environmental review, and the last thing standing in their way was Joshua tree permitting. And ultimately, large-scale solar supported this bill while they opposed California Endangered Species Act protection, because this bill provides at least a standardized process where they can know up front how much it's going to cost and base their siting and financing decisions upon that. And, you know, the law has these various check-ins and provisions to raise permit fees over time if they're not adequate. And I think that will ultimately result in more and more solar being sited in better places. You know, I've talked with some of the solar companies, and one of the ones that was most active in creating the bill was like, yes, we have these two or three projects already planned. We need to build them. We need Joshua tree permits. But everything else we're doing, we're putting in the Central Valley on farmlands that have been taken out of production because of salinity or other issues. So I hope this is a step in the change in the right direction, so we no longer, you know, destroy intact desert habitat, which is one of the most essential things, if, you know, for ecosystem survival or ecosystem adaption in an era of climate change. But it's a tough issue, and it's been a political issue that's roiled desert communities of, mm-hmm. you know, we are experiencing the heating as fast as anywhere. We need to address climate change, but we don't want to see the desert mowed down and paved over with solar panels.
Well, it's a very stark example of the trade-offs and the need for good planning for where to site these projects. And Professor Barrows, we're just almost a bit out of time here, but I wanted to ask you for your take on this issue. What are some of the impacts to the desert ecosystem when we have some of this large-scale solar development? What is your perspective on this argument that we do need to triple our build out? We can only do so much on rooftops and already built land, et cetera. So how do we think about the trade-offs with development in the desert versus the need to preserve species and the need to decarbonize as rapidly as possible?
Well, not surprisingly, I agree with everything Brendan said. I think one of the things that some of the research that is happening from UC Riverside and elsewhere is finding is that one of the carbon initiatives is to sequester carbon and to get carbon out of the atmosphere and into the ground or something, not in the atmosphere. And so if you think about that, a lot of people say, well, the Amazon forest, that's this place. There's this huge amount of photosynthesis happening and the plants are taking carbon out of the atmosphere. The irony there is that they're not the plants, but the microorganisms that are in the soil in and around the plants are throwing out just as much carbon as they're taking in. That's in a tropical forest. But when the scientists have started looking at our deserts and saying, well, is that what's happening here? It turns out, at least with the preliminary research, is that by leaving a desert pristine, not scraping it down and removing the Joshua trees and all the other plants, that forest, that habitat is sequestering carbon and putting it into the soil, and it's not letting it out again because it's such a dry soil. There's not this huge microbial activity that's generating its own carbon and throwing it back into the atmosphere. And so this is this part of the story that people are just starting to understand, is that by leaving the desert alone as much as we possibly can and focusing as much as we can on already developed or disturbed lands and rooftops, we are sort of shooting ourselves in the foot because the desert is actually helping us by sequestering carbon. So if it comes to the equation comes out and says, well, we still need to disturb the desert to meet our goals. There's just no way around it. I'm not sure I agree with that, but if that's the way it turns out, then I would argue that you go to those places that are already the most severely impacted by climate change, that we've already lost the Joshua trees. We've already lost so much of the biodiversity there, the tortoises and all of the other animals that are only found in that habitat. And if we go to those areas and that's where you're going to put the solar, the loss is much less than if you go to some of these areas that the impacts have not been as severe quite yet.
Well, there's a lot we could talk about between the desert, renewable energy, and the threats to our ecosystems and species. But unfortunately, we're out of time. And I just want to thank you both for covering this important issue of the Western Joshua Tree and its future. That's Brendan Cummings, Conservation Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, and Dr. Cameron Barrows, Professor Emeritus and Research Ecologist at UC Riverside. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
And we'll be back just after this short break with more on Your Calls One Planet series, including coverage of fossil-free media's campaign against big oil. So stay with us.